answer is the experiments need something called a trigger. This is a device that lets them select a fraction of events that they can write out, and typically that number is around 10 to the minus 5. So 99.999% of the collisions that happen are never recorded. And you're all nodding your heads like, yeah, this sounds like a perfectly reasonable thing. This is a completely unreasonable thing. You want to record every event. The only reason we hold ourselves to 0.001% is because we have to.
You're saying this is where all the beyond the center model happens.
This is the thing that keeps me up at night, is that we have seen many BSM events and we haven't recorded a one of them because we didn't have the sense to say, BSM looks like this and not that. So you certainly need to write out the events that you're interested in, but you also need to write out the events, you need to understand the events that you're interested in. So for example, B sub S looks like a fairly wide range here where the B sub S is a narrow resonance. The reason is if they just recorded events on resonance, they'd have no idea what the background was and they wouldn't be able to count them. So you need to be able to, in this case, record events to the left and to the right on the mass plot so you can see if you have a bump. In many cases, it's more complicated than this. If I'm interested in jets above 1,000 GeV, there's no problem in triggering on that, but I don't know the relation between those jets and down to 20 GeV because I haven't recorded any of those. So what you need to do is record a set of samples that overlaps so that you understand the thousands from the 500s, the 500s from the 200s, the 200s from the 100s, all the way on down. So I'm going to oversimplify triggering and stick it on one slide. We can talk more about this later, because if I put more than one slide in here, I'm going to start going on and on and on, because this is something I find personally interesting and important. Yes. That's the thing you're going to ask a question about?
Yeah. The problem is you don't have enough disk space to store or bandwidth to take out the data.
Fundamentally, the problem is we don't have enough money. Okay. So we have disk to store for a couple of days worth of data on site. So if the downstream processing ever stops, okay, we've got a couple of days to deal with that before that becomes a crisis. But ultimately, we have, as I said yesterday, we have on each experiment between 100 and 150,000 CPUs processing the data. That allows us to process something on the order of 500 hertz to a kilohertz worth of data. If we record any more of that, it never gets analyzed because we can't do that. So ultimately, that 10 to the minus 5 number is driven by how much downstream processing that you have. And that's driven by how much money you have. So if you were to, say, invent BlackBerry and had money you didn't know what to do with, one of the things you could do is allow the experiments to take more data. Just to pick up random example.
What does it mean? What did you say? Like a kilohertz worth of data? I was expecting some sort of like temporal unit worth of data.
As opposed to an inverse temporal unit?
Yes. So like 3 hours worth of data, not.
So we write we write data at a rate of 1 kilohertz, so 1,000 events per second, right? We run for 10 to the 7 seconds in a year.
Okay.
So if I did that, do the math right, that means we write out 10 billion events per year. Okay. You know, everyone knows there are 10 to the 7th useful seconds in a year and pi times 10 to the 7th seconds in a year.
What about the others? Why are they not useful?
So the experiment does not run 100% of the time. Right? There's periods of time that the beam is being developed. There's periods of time when you're injecting. There's some, you know, but if you work it all out, you're actually running pretty much any experiment, not just in particle physics, a little bit better than around a third of the time. And since there's pi times 10 to the 7 seconds in the year, there's 10 to the 7th useful seconds in a year.
I have a question about the slide before again.
I'm glad it's not a question about why is it pi times 10 to the 7th. It had to be something.
So this is from scouting data. Like, how do you reach such low mass resonances with normal?
So I don't know exactly the trigger stream these came in on, but there are probably roughly one eta, one omega, and half of a phi, and 5 or 6 rows per event. So if you just plot those masses, you're going to get them anyway. Remember.
So if you put like a high, if you put like a 5 GeV PT cut on the muons or something, you can, that event will still contain some ETAs. That's
true. But I think it's also the fact that you've got 70 pileup events that you also have, which could also produce these. So you might have taken these events because it had some other reason that you thought was interesting, but there are still the low mass resonances.
In that data.
All right. I'm going to oversimplify the triggering. Basically, there are two levels, and the numbering of the levels can be crazy, like, you know, 0 and 1 or 0 and 3 or 0.5. But there's really two ways to do it. At the lowest level, it's usually done by hardware, and it looks at a subset of the detectors that have a very fast signal formation time. So if I have a calorimeter, sampling calorimeter that uses scintillator, the signal formation time in scintillator is typically 50 to 75 nanoseconds. So 50 nanoseconds after the collision, I've got a signal, and I can say, ah, this is an interesting event or not. If I have to drift it over gas, right? That could take as long as microseconds. So I've had many, many more collisions. I can't trigger on that. I need to know from something faster if this event is interesting. The decision that's made at this level is not yes or no. It's yes or maybe. I'm sorry. It's no or maybe. This is wrong. I'll fix it later. It's no or maybe. You can always throw an event away, right? And then maybe means you take a look at it later. Boy, you know, and I've shown this slide before, and I'm sure it was right then. Anyway, you have 25 nanoseconds. Every 25 nanoseconds, you've got another event coming, and you've got to be able to process it. But that doesn't mean you have to make a decision in 25 nanoseconds. We set up a pipeline, like a parade of events. And by, say, event 40 or event 50, whatever that depth of the pipeline is, you have to know whether to take an event out of that pipeline, or to let it fall off the edge. If the answer, all right, so LHC 1 microsecond is 50 events deep, 2 microseconds, 100 events, and so on. Typically, the rejections you get are around 100, or I'm sorry, around 1,000 with a factor of few uncertainty on either side. After this, you have software level triggering. Now that I've cut the rate down from, in this case, you know, many kilohertz to maybe a few kilohertz, I have much more time I can look at an event. So typically you run these on large clusters, large being a few hundred of, I say, near commodity computers. The regular computers that you buy, we buy them from Dell, but most of them have a board in the back of them that allows the data to come from the detector to come in. They can run anything from fast algorithms to full reconstruction, and often they do. So let's say you thought you had an electron and that was the reason the event was interesting. The first thing you'll do is you'll say, okay, the early level trigger thought this was an interesting electron. Is that an electron at all? And it'll just look at that electron, and if the answer is no, it won't do anything with it. If the answer is yes, then it may say, all right, let's reconstruct the full event and see if it's still something I want to keep. Right. So it only analyzes the fraction of the events that are passed by this, but can analyze the whole event. And this gives you, again, a similar rejection factor, and the product is typically 100,000. So that's what we do. How many of you are terrified that we do this wrong? Exactly. That is exactly right.
Are you going to tell us what the criterion is that you use to check things?
So to check things.
Or not check things.
So to check things, what we do, there's a couple of ways we have to get around that. One of them is we have decided that every, let's say, second or half second or 2 seconds or whatever the event is, we write that guy out. So the trigger gives a free pass to a certain number of events so we can look and see, does it make the right decision? In fact, it's better to do this into two pieces. So we take a certain fraction of all events and a certain fraction of events that pass the trigger one before, so you can look at samples that are enriched and things that you might want. The other thing that we can do is, because we have all this pileup, you can look at those events, which you took in a completely unbiased way. They occurred because something else interesting happened, and ask, does the trigger make the right decision on those events? But yes, we are continually checking to make sure that the trigger doesn't make a mistake. One of the things that really scared us, and we even had some evidence for that on CDF, is that we were very worried that the trigger would work fine if it had a small number of triggers, but if it passed a large number of triggers, it would make the wrong decision. And that's almost impossible to check this way. And that would say the only events we throw out are the most interesting ones of all. So we, you know, we're continually trying to check as much as we can to make sure we didn't make that particular mistake.
In your later slides, will you tell us what the, when you make your decision, what's the criterion? Is it you're asking for an electron to be there, or what's the?
Right. So let's say you're looking for a W. W is an E nu. So you expect to have an electron, you expect to have missing energy. You can trigger on either of those things. And what you'd like is your W's to come in on both triggers, and you can look at the ones that trigger on one and say, how often did it figure on the other? Typically, what you would do at the hardware level for an electron is ask for energy in the calorimeter for the electron. And at the software level, you'd ask to see if there's a track pointing at it, because the tracking takes longer to do than the calorimetry. So you would pick anything that looked electromagnetic in the calorimeter with a threshold of, say, 20 GeV. You'd ask for a track of, say, 25 GeV pointing at it. And because the W weighs 80, typically it's 40 GeV of energy on each side of these things. So you have a threshold well below where you're ultimately going to be cutting.
That's what I do if I'm looking for something like a W. But you said that like only 1 in 10 to the 5 events get saved at all to be looked at. Is there a simple way of saying what it is that?
No, there are on Atlas 256 different hardware triggers. And there's probably 1,000 software triggers. Right? So you have the main triggers are single electrons of high PT, single muons of high PT, but they might have several triggers that do that, so you can back up one with the other. And then people who aren't interested in leptons are interested in jets, so you've got a bunch of jet triggers and so on. So it's a huge menu. You can think about this. Do we have astronomers in here? Okay, good. So we have what's called the trigger working group, which is the equivalent of a telescope allocation committee. Whereas a telescope allocation committee will say, okay, out of this year, you get 2 days to look at whatever you'd like. Well, we do the same thing here as in bandwidth. We say out of 1,000 hertz, you get 5 hertz to do what you want. You get 7 hertz to do what you want. And we divvy it all up that way. Right? And that's where the physics program comes about. This is one of the reasons why triggering is near and dear to my heart, because if you want to do a certain kind of physics, you have to be able to explain to that body why you want to do that, how much data you need, how you intend to collect it, what backups you need. It's essentially a scientific program inside a scientific program to go and get what you need to do to your analysis. Yes?
Would triggering not prevent you from finding something totally unexpected?
So, that is my fear, but since we're telling stories, we had, if I can find a piece of chalk. I'm sure there's chalk here somewhere.
One of the trays, probably all the boards have been up.
There's a little tiny microscopic piece of chalk here.
It's one of your coat.
Huh. There's a little tiny milliscopic piece of chalk here. No, it's fine. We had events in CDF that looked like that. Everyone see that? Nobody intended these things. We call them broomstick events because that's what they looked like. If you look carefully at the muon, you discover there are two muons, opposite charge, very high PT, very low mass, sitting right next to each other. You also discovered that there was almost no missing ET in these events. We didn't know what the heck these things were. There was no mass bump or anything on these, no sign that this was anything, any kind of new particle, but nonetheless, these were events that we had not expected to see. Anyone want to guess what these things are? These are its quark gluon, bounces out and produces quark photon, and that photon converts to a mu pair rather than an electron pair. And this is very rare because muons are heavy, so you're suppressed by, I think, an m squared, so that's 40,000. Right? Nobody intended to find these guys, to look for these guys, but nevertheless, they showed up in the data stream. We call these zoo events. But we continually look at zoo events to make sure that, you know, I felt good about these, even though there's no new physics in them. And the old physics that's in them is not particularly interesting. But it let us know that something that we did not plan to search for on day one is still showing up in the stream. So that made us feel good. But you can't prove that there's not something else that we would never find. You should be terrified by the thought that there's a trigger. Yes?
So in terms of trigger selection, what's preventing you from dumping all the data somewhere and then looking at it later? Is it a limitation on the storage space, or is it like there's the number of events arriving you need to clear each?
So it would take, if we were to do a full analysis of every event that we take, that would take us 10 to the 5 years per year of data taking.
Processing.
That's right.
Why couldn't you just store it all and hope that in 20 years you'll have much better processors and be able to do it all fast?
Because we spend as much money on disk as we do on processing. Okay. So we would be able to afford to do that for an hour. Maybe.
Okay.
Right.
Would it be possible to like store it for long enough to do a more in-depth, not like a full analysis, but a more in-depth, rather than the very fast microseconds to figure out whether or not you should store it just to do it more detailed?
I'm going to mock you for a second, and then I'm going to answer your question. You use the word just. Anytime someone uses the word just, you can stop listening beyond that. Can you just? It never made, no. So the answer is actually yes. All right, so that's why it was okay to mock her, because she was right. An event that's, you know, we don't have to clear out an old event until a new event is ready to come on. So we can hold on to events for a while, and there are things called trigger level analyses where you fill a histogram that you have set up from the very beginning based on events while they are in flight in your system, but you never get a chance to look at that event ever again. Right, so this is a mix between what we were talking about. You can't analyze these events in the sort of detail that you would like, but you're able to take advantage of the fact that, you know, they're in short-term memory and not long-term memory, that I can learn something about them. The evil dark side of that kind of analysis is you can never change it once you've started it. So you're halfway down the line, you say, I've got this great idea. The best you can do is start a second analysis that does that. Are we still friends?
No.
Okay, good. Yes?
How often would they update the hardware level trigger?
There is generally a complete refresh in the hardware on a sort of 5-year time scale. However, it's not always it's been 5 years, let's gut everything and put all new stuff there. There tend to be incremental improvements as you go. And one of the things that does is it sort of locks you into technological choices that were made years ago, right? Because you needed to do that, even though they don't make any sense anymore. And the piece of hardware that was driving that decision might not even exist anymore, but A had to be compatible with B, and B had to be compatible with C, and so on and so forth. More questions?
Is there a go-to place, if you're a theorist who wants to think of things that you're not seeing in your triggers, is there a go-to place where it's easy for, you know, theory accessible to read what your list of things is that you're...
There's not even a place for that's experimentally accessible. So both experiments have published their trigger menus, but if you're not a real expert, you don't know exactly what's in them. On the other hand, I think if you're a phenomenologist, you probably only need to know approximately what's in them. Right. If you say 30 GeV muon and 30 GeV electron, that's probably good enough, and you don't need to know exactly what the definition is. So for most things, I think that's fine. If you're interested in truly exotic things, millicharge particles or something, then I think you need to really get embedded in the experiment and understand in some detail. That's probably about as wacky as it gets. Or quarks. Have you ever read the paper Quarks by Marcus Luddy? So the question is, what happens if you have confinement on a very long scale? You have two quarks, but they're still attached by a string, and they move, but not completely independently. These give you really weird-looking tracks. How do you know that you trigger on them? And the basic answer is, you don't. All right. I'm going to briefly review what we did yesterday about photon identification as we move on. This was the Atlas electromagnetic calorimeter. If you remember, it's fairly large, about one story. Has resolution that's quite good, but not nearly as good as CMS's, which is basically twice as good, which uses crystals. All right. This is the important piece of this, is the design philosophies varied. CMS wanted very, very good energy resolution. The idea was to get a nice narrow Higgs peak. That's why they use crystals. That was expensive. And that meant that since it's expensive, the calorimeter has to be small. And since it's got to be small, that means it's got to be close in. Atlas said, let's build one that's less expensive. That lets us build one at farther out. That gets the backgrounds a chance to spread more so that you have a clearer picture of what's going on and to do a better job of determining whether you had a photon or two photons or more. And both are quite thick. All right. Reason I wanted to review calorimeters is now we're going to talk about jets. This is the two-slide review of what jets are. They're a blast of particles all going in the same direction. All right, that's a jet, that's a jet, that's a jet, that's a jet, and so on. We often look at what we call a Lego plot, and the Lego company was not happy about UA1 using their terminology, but they made an agreement. This is essentially taking the calorimeter, unrolling it, and plotting how much energy is in every individual cell. So these two cells are filled with energy. These two cells are filled with energy. And around that, you have a little bit less energy. That sort of agrees with what you see here. You've got a concentrated energy area with a lot of energy and nearby less, and so on and so forth. And the reason you have these is because you can't pluck a quark out of a proton. If the force between two colored objects is roughly independent of distance, and we can have all sorts of arguments about how roughly is roughly, if that's true, the potential energy grows linearly with distance. And when it gets big enough, it pops a quark-anti-quark pair out of the background. So I take this particle, I grab the red quark, and I pull, and I pull, and I pull. And eventually, I've pushed enough energy into the system to form a pion. And this string holding them together breaks, and I find myself holding a pion rather than a quark. Right? This is called fragmentation or hadronization. And it turns out this is actually helpful and not harmful. What looks to be a very inelastic process. So I have protons come here, they break apart after the collision, and a bunch of particles come out here, is actually the elastic scattering of two constituents of the proton. So that quark and that quark scatter elastically, and these produce the jets by putting particles around them. So if I measure the four momentum of the jet, I've measured the four momentum of the constituent. I don't need to know and don't care if it fragmented into protons and antiprotons or pions or kaons. None of that makes any difference. All I need is the total energy. Does this make any sense? Yes? So the fact, by ignoring that information, it actually makes things clearer. So this is a Lego plot of a simulated top quark event. It has 1, 2, 3, 4 obvious jets. This thing there and that thing there are less obvious what's going on. Maybe it's a jet, maybe it's not. Electromagnetic energy is in green and hadronic energy is in red. So the fact that you see all this green comes about from two factors. One is that half of the particles in jets are photons, 40% or so of the energy, from pi 0 to k or eta to k. So even though we think of jets as hadronic objects, it's actually they're being measured by the electromagnetic calorimeter. The other reason is the LHCEM calorimeters are made very, very thick, and the hadrons begin their showers inside the calorimeters, the EM calorimeters, so they deposit EM energy. Right, so we know the energy by the calorimeter. We don't say this is this kind of energy, this is that kind of energy. Energy is energy. In real life, this is what these look like. I was actually responsible for pieces of the construction of this. This is the Atlas tile calorimeter. The absorber is steel, and it uses scintillating tiles, plastic that scintillates when particles traverse it. It has the active medium in this direction over here. These are the scintillating tiles. The blue is not real. It comes from the flash of the camera. And this person is connecting all the scintillating fibers that read these out to the right photo tube. This turned out, how do you know that you've got the right fibers on the right photo tubes? Turns out the answer is to do the problem exactly in reverse. To take the photo tube, shine light through that cookie, and see which fibers light up, and to make sure they're pointing in the right direction. So we did this all with exactly zero errors. We picked this particular technology because you could build this in many different places. So the natural technology you would use would be liquid argon, which is what the EM calorimeter used. That would be the obvious thing to do, is to just build a bigger cryostat. But then the only place in the world you could build this would be CERN, because there's no way you'd be able to transport the cryostat anywhere. So instead, we used a different technology. The central barrel, this is a central barrel, this is a central barrel. So this was built in Dubna in Russia. On the A side, which would be here, it was built at Argonne National Laboratory, and the C side here was built in Catalonia. So we carefully labeled which side was which by the institute who built it.
Question?
Yes.
If you're using steel, how far does this part have to be from those magnetic fields to keep you from having problems?
Well, it's inside. The coil is on the inside, and this is the return flux for the coil. So in fact, that the magnetic fields are going right through that. The problem with that actually is down here, which is where the power supplies are. Have you ever looked at a power supply? Right, what does it have in it? It's got coils, right? If you have a magnetic field going through the coils, you have problems. So we in fact had to build power supplies specifically to deal with operating in a high magnetic field. There are two ways you can have power supplies. You can have linears and switchers. A linear is you put X voltages in and you get NX out. A switcher turns on and off over time. Problem with switchers is switchers in a magnetic field feel a force through the current in the wires that varies. If you happen to hit a resonance, what ends up happening is that your power supply goes in some direction that you did not intend. So we had to think about these things. Yes?
Does each tile correspond to like a Lego block? I'm just trying to figure out like how to scale this to your...
So these things here that are marked or that are painted, each of those is one Lego block.
So
they might have
a couple of those blocks, and that's how big we should think of a jet. Like,
so a jet would be kind of that sort of size. And it would cross probably 10 of those modules. You're looking at 1/64th of the detector. By the way, it's shimmed with US dimes, because it turns out that you can buy a US dime for 10 cents and they're all identical and people carry them. And if you need a shim that's just that size, you've got one.
Sure, some of them are Canadian dimes?
I'm pretty sure. At the time, the loonie was above the dollar, so no one was going to let those go. Yes?
Why are some of the tiles different sizes? Or is that just not
seeing? You mean here, different sizes here?
Yeah.
So this has two tiles. This is two. So at that level, they're the same. But the real on the other axis, they're not, because this is projective. This goes around. So this is at low radius. This is at large radius. So the tiles have to line up. This is, in fact, one of the things that I did, because the size of the tile as specified by the angle and the size of the tile as specified by the order did not match. Now, one of the things I had to do was to figure out what it was that we actually built. What you want to build, what you think you've built, what you've actually built, these are all different things that you hope are closely related. But you really want to understand what was the thing that I actually put in the beam.
Wait, one more question. When you increase the center of mass energy, do you expect the, like naively, I think the jet would become like more boosted, so like, you would have like less resolution because you're like looking at the jet through less tiles.
Are you talking about angular resolution or energy resolution?
Angular. So like if you like two jets that become like merged or something, like is there a limit that like past like, I don't know how much energy the LHC will eventually reach, but when like let's say 20 TeV or something, when like we won't be able to distinguish jet like fat jets or something anymore.
So the problem with fat jets is how fat is not a well-defined quantity. But basically, you're looking at a number like the mass over the energy as the rough angle of what you're talking about. So if I have, say, a top weighs 175 over 1.75 TeV, so it'll work out well, right? That's 1/10. That's 5 degrees. All right, so you have even a 2 TeV top is going to have roughly five degrees of separation. All right, this being 1/64 is 5 degrees. So at the very top end, you can see you're starting to come through. As jets get more energetic, though, in general, they get fatter, not skinnier.
Okay.
Because what happens is the whole thing gets boosted up. And you're right, the core gets smaller, but I have some threshold beyond which I'm not seeing. And more particles that were at low energy are now above that threshold because they're getting scooped in. So it works backwards from the way you might think.
Yeah, I
do. This is CMS's calorimeter. It's also scintillating tile-based. The tiles go, in this case, the opposite direction to Atlas. Atlas, they go this way. CMS, they go that way. That's a construction decision. It had nothing to do with physics. Technology is very similar to Atlas. Because they don't have a lot of space, they built it out of brass as opposed to steel. Right? Brass has a density of about 9. Steel has a density of about 5. So they're able to get almost twice as much material in. And the calorimeter is relatively thin. So they have more particles that leak out of the back than Atlas. So again, let's compare the design philosophies. CMS's calorimeter is inside their magnets. And now additional depth becomes very, very, very expensive because it requires you to build a bigger and bigger magnet. Magnets are not cheap. So to increase their thickness, they made it out of brass. Atlas, on the other hand, is very thick. And the outer muon detector is designed to be like the iron ball, that not a whole lot that are not muons make it outside of Atlas. As I said before, Atlas would naturally use liquid argon for both the hadronic and electromagnetic calorimeters. D0 did this, H1 did this. This is also very expensive. And as I said, there's only one place in the world you could build it because you wouldn't be able to ship the calorimeter anywhere. So both experiments have chosen this is a good place to save money because this is a place where if you want to do a little bit better, it's going to cost you a whole ton of money more. So let's do what we can do simply and straightforwardly, and stop there. The other reason is there's a lot of things. I mean, the cloud is there because, remember, hadronic jets are like snowflakes, right? Everyone is different. And what this does is it's a very fuzzy object, and getting a very, very clear picture of a very, very fuzzy object doesn't help you a whole lot. So that's why they backed off there. A lot of things beyond the hadronic calorimeter response affect the jet energy. The EM calorimeter response, because that's where half of the energy is going. Things like out-of-cone corrections, deciding what is in my jet, what is not my jet. Dead material, the corrections for that. All of these things happen. So having a perfect hadron calorimeter actually doesn't get you much better response than was actually built. Let's go back to tracking for a second. Figure of merit for momentum is BL squared, right? So the idea is if you have a half dozen layers of silicon close, it tells to the interaction point, it's very good about picking the whether there's a flight distance to that track or not. But it's not so good about measuring the momentum because effectively your detector is that big rather than that big. So to improve on this, the momentum resolution, the experiments build out from their silicon detector. So this is CMS's. This part here in purple gives a very good picture of what's going on in the vertex, and they kept building out and out and out and out and out. All right, so they decided that they would add another six or so silicon layers. This is by far the biggest silicon AGP detector ever built. It's measured in acres. It's truly enormous. And to remind you here, to tell an electron from a photon, an electron has a track in front of the energy cluster, and a photon doesn't. These are what the detectors look like in real life. That's a sensor. It's essentially the same thing that's on the camera of your phone. And you just put a lot of these together. This is CMS, so that must be Atlas. Yeah, it's Atlas. And you see layers and layers and layers and layers and layers. So a particle that goes through has many, many measurements in the silicon, which lets us go together. Now, Atlas decided that instead of adding 6 points or so on the outside like CMS did, they were going to add 36 pretty good points. So instead of having six truly exquisite measurements, they were going to have a large number of measurements that weren't so hot. And this is done with a straw tracker. So you have a wire inside a straw. The straw has gas. The particle goes through, ionizes the gas, drifts to the wire. And Atlas had the clever idea of, let's fill these with xenon, so you have transition radiation. Any of you know what transition radiation is? It's in chapter 14 of Jackson.
That's why.
How many of you have warm, fuzzy feelings when you think of Jackson? That's what that's deeply disturbing. So if I have a charged particle cross a medium, so think about Cherenkov light for a second. That's a continuous case. Charged particle is moving faster than the speed of light in a vacuum, you get radiation. Transition radiation happens when you have a break. You have a particle that may or may not be going faster than the speed of light, but the transition from one index of refraction to the other causes radiation. So that's hence transition radiation. So electrons, which are screaming along, give you a lot of transition radiation, whereas pions, which are relatively pokey, do not. So we get more energetic hits from electrons than we do from pions. So if you look at this track, which is a pion, the bluish are the low energy hits, the red are the high, and you see the pion has maybe a few, whereas the electron has more. This is an electron here. Right, you can see this cluster of tracks over here, this electron over there. Right? Since this detector will not work at the very highest luminosity, Atlas may replace this with silicon. We're going to replace this with silicon. Right? At the highest luminosities, everything here is lit. It's hard to find tracks when every point is on. So let's go back to an event that I showed you yesterday. This is one of our Higgs candidates. That one was a photon, no track in front of it. This one is a photon that has two tracks in front of it. This one is an electron, which gives you a shower there. This one that's curving is a low energy positron, gives you a small shower there. This is our category 5 event. But if you look at let's look at this in a little more detail. This is the conversion, these two tracks. You see all those red lights, those red spots on that. So we not only know that we have a low mass pair of tracks pointing at what looks like electromagnetic energy, so looks like a photon that's converted, but we also know that those two tracks look an awful lot like electrons. So what you're starting to see, I hope, is the chain of inference takes a large number of facts, none of which is perfect by itself, to drive an inference that this track is an electron because I have two electrons, it's of opposite charge, it probably was a photon. The tracks look like a photon conversion. The energy looks electromagnetic. We'll put this in the Higgs search. Any questions before I go on to missing ET? Missing transverse energy. We know momentum is conserved, right? With this bunch, do I have to explain that? Noether's theorem, translational invariance. It just pops right out. So if you see something like this, where the purple is an inference, what you really just see is one electron going out here. This is from the D0 experiment, and nothing balancing it. You have two choices. Choice one, momentum is not conserved. Choice two, something invisible went the other way. So we work under the assumption that something invisible went the other way. We call it missing ET. And in this case, it's almost certainly due to a missing neutrino, because W's decay to electrons on neutrinos. So what we do is we add up all of the energy that we see. That gives us a direction, and then we subtract it and say, ah, that's the missing energy. We only work in the transverse plane because the experiments have holes in them for the beams to come in, and stuff goes flying out those holes. We can't measure anything there. So if we had a if we had a detector that had a shutter that could close in a few picoseconds, right, we would be able to work in transverse energy in three dimensions, or missing energy in three dimensions, but we have to work in missing transverse energy. This is where the T in ET comes from. Yes?
I thought with an electron-positron collider, you can do this full angular thing. At least someone told me once that, like, in the proton, you don't know what the exact momentum of the protons is. This is why we have to use ET instead of...
Hold that thought. I'm guessing in 22 minutes you'll have an answer to that. If you can't be accurate, at least be precise. So, neutralinos are the new neutrinos here. In supersymmetry, every fermion has a boson that its partner and vice versa. So, for example, a photon's partner would be a photino, which mixes with other things and so forth. The lightest supersymmetric particle is stable. Photino, for example, can't decay to nu bar. That violates angular momentum. Spin a half, spin a half, spin a half. Can't decay to E plus E minus neutrino. That violates conservation of lepton numbers. Can't go to three neutrons. That violates conservation of baryon number, and so on. This is called R-parity conservation. It keeps your supersymmetric theory from violating limits, and the biggest one is proton decay. If you have an R-parity violating theory, you have to be very careful to avoid proton decay. So this leads to a very common signature in SUSY models, particles that exit your detector without interacting, and that leads to missing momentum. And if you start down this theme, you can have more exotic things. You can have KK models where you replicate the whole standard model. So you've got fields there that are like neutrinos, but heavier. Again, they would behave like neutrinos in the detector. KK graviton would do this. And depending on the model, you might get more. And there are even more exotic theories, names like Hidden Valley and Shadow Matter and all of this. And the point is not to pick which theory is right and which theory is wrong, like SUSY. The point is that missing ET is a signature that many models have and that experiments should look for. Another way to look at it is there is some dark matter particle. You would like to know if you produce it. The issue came up, and this is starting to answer your question, but not in a good way yet, is hermeticity, which is a way that people with PhDs say holes in your detector are bad. Okay. If I have a diejet event like this, I see this, and we make zillions of diejet events, I see this jet, but that jet is going down the hole. So it's going to give me fake missing ET, because there's nothing that I can see that's balancing this. All right. So it's real missing ET in the sense that it's truly missing. It's not detected at all, but it's fake in the sense it's not what I'm looking for, right? It's, you know, discovering that your detector has a hole in it is not the sort of thing that PRL wants to publish. Right? So the difference here is really between an undetected particle like this and a neutrino, which is an undetectable particle. The problem is the holes and the gaps and the cracks are all necessary. You have a minimum of two holes. The beam has to come in. Cables need to come out somewhere. Cooling has to go in. Cryogens have to come in. The heat from these has to come out. All right? If I'm sending some freon in to cool my silicon, I can't just let it puddle inside the detector. I need another pipe on the other end to take it all out. So this is CDF. This is what the hole in CDF looks like. It's just filled with all sorts of stuff. So you're stuck with the hole. So given that I'm stuck with a hole, what do I do? Well, I can try to make the hole smaller, but there's a limit to this. I've bought a certain amount of, you know, I need a certain number of cables to come in and out. I can't make it any smaller than that. Or I can make the detector longer. If I take this event, I would have fake missing ET in that detector, but if I make the detector really, really, really long, now I can see this jet because it's on the inside rather than the outside. So the solution is simple, right? I just make my detectors an infinite length and everything is fine, and I'm done, I can go home. So why don't you do this? Why don't you just make the detectors longer and longer and longer and longer and longer? So resource limitations are the obvious thing, right? If I make it twice as big, it's twice as much money. But also, that means it needs twice as many people to build it or to take twice as long. So there are practical limits for what I can build there. But also, relativistic kinematics is important. And this is a box around it. I wish someone had told me this sooner, because I wish somebody had told me this sooner. So if you produce a heavy object, it's sitting almost at rest. Right, it takes all of the energy that I can to make this guy. It's not screaming along, right? The energy is going into mass, not into kinetic energy, right? And that means that decay products are going to populate things more or less uniformly, all 4 pi steradians of solid angle. Right? So the key that matters for something that's heavy is solid angle. If it's light, they're produced uniformly across rapidity. All right, now in principle, that argues for a long detector, but if it's light, the cross-section is large and I'm making a lot of them. If I'm making a lot of them, you've seen one, you've seen them all, I don't need to have a detector that's very long to see every last B particle that's produced, because there's always another one that I can trigger on. If I can't trigger on all the ones that I'm making anyway, why do I want to record, you know, build a detector that lets me miss even more of them? So one unit of rapidity is as good as the other. So either heavy or light, it does, at some point, it stops making sense to build them longer and longer and longer. So that's why the experiments are the length that they are. Yes?
To what extent can you determine the direction of the missing momentum? Like, here you're reconstructing, can you detect, figure out which direction it should have been going?
So let's pretend, it's a very good question. It has multiple answers. So I'm going to reframe the question several different ways, answer them, and then you can tell me if I've answered your question. So one question is, if I'm working in the I'm missing this guy here. I'm working in the transverse plane. How well can I measure where this missing energy is in the transverse plane? And the answer to that's a couple of degrees. So 5-ish degrees, and it varies. The more missing ET I have, the better I can understand where it's going to. But a couple degrees is the ballpark. But let's say instead of being a dijet, this was a W, right? So I've got an electron or a muon and a neutrino, right? I can measure, again, the transverse direction quite accurately. What can I do about the longitudinal direction? And the answer is, for a W, because I know its mass, there are two solutions for where the neutrino could be going. So I can determine within a degeneracy of 2 in theta where that neutrino was. This sounds good, except that most of the events that we're interested in that have W's have 2 of them. And this trick doesn't work out if you have, you know, I have one measurement, I can squeeze one number out of it, I can't squeeze 2 numbers out of it. So that's the issue there. Also, sometimes things aren't measured really well, and what you discover is instead of 2 solutions, you have 0 because they're imaginary. And if you read our papers, the experiments go to a long detail of explaining what exactly they do when the algebra doesn't work out. In most cases, what they do is they just pick the real component because, well, you got to do something. So that's 2 answers to your question. Did I answer either of the questions that you had in your mind?
Fundamentally, the question I was thinking about was, to what degree can you figure out if the missing energy is pointing out a hole?
So you can't tell in this case that it's in a hole because it's in the direction that you're not measuring. It's not transverse. So a hole that's in the front or the back, you're stuck. If it's pointing at a crack, it's a little bit harder. What you normally do is you say, this jet is pointing at a crack. So I've probably mismeasured it, and I'm going to talk about mismeasured jets in a bit. Yes, sir?
If you make your detector longer, Dave, you need more cracks,
You don't necessarily need more cracks, but you probably need bigger cracks.
Does that play any kind of role in optimizing how long?
Probably not a whole lot. I think really it's basically when you run out of resources, either the dollars you have to build it or the people that you have.
I'm sorry, what is a crack in this context? I assume that was not an intentional thing. I don't know why you would need...
Oh no, there's the cracks. There's intentional cracks everywhere. Let me show you some pictures of intentional cracks. All right. It's maybe easier to do with CMS. Besides, there are opponents, so it's better to point out the flaws in their experiment. But you see, there's a crack here. Right? Because all of these pieces that come together, right? Essentially, you are looking at a whole crack right here. Right, so, yes, we build cracks in all the time. We love our cracks. Yes?
So if you're using missing transverse energy to look for new physics, is it fair to say that if your new physics is at the electroweak level, it's harder to determine, or is it actually possible to determine, like, distinguish your signature between a missing neutrino energy or just something exotic?
So, first of all, you asked, is it fair? You've heard me lecture for about 4 hours now. Does fairness sound like anything that I'm particularly interested in? Okay, so let's put fairness aside. So you have real missing ET from neutrinos in events that you're looking at. And how you deal with that is analysis dependent. So let's talk about Susie, for example. I'm asking myself in events that have a large number of jets in them, do I have an excess in missing ET? My background in that are Z decays to neutrinos with events with many jets in them. So at some level, those start to merge together. So when the kinematics look very different, I can say, I can tell them apart. And as they get closer and closer, look more and more similar, that becomes harder. And that's why the limit plots eventually go away. Because essentially, your signal is melting into your background. It looks so much like backgrounds that you know about and can't predict to within X percent that you can't actually do a search. That's why, on day one, I said my interests involve the intersection between standard model and BSM physics. Because if I can measure, say, Z plus N jets better, and I can constrain models, and that lets me search near that boundary all the better. So that's why I do what I do. All right, let's see where we are now. So back on to length. This is Atlas. This is D0. You can sort of see that Atlas is longer, but not crazy long. So this transition from central to forward happens about there in Atlas. So 50% longer, factor of two longer, and so on. And this is for the two reasons we talked about before. Missing ET performance tells you that long is good, and the kinematics tells you that it's not, you know, building it crazy long doesn't really help you. Now let's talk about mismeasured jets. I'm going to apologize to Spinal Tap for that picture. One way to generate fake missing ET is to mismeasure an object. Jets are the usual suspects, rather than electrons or muons and so on. Right? First reason is there's a lot of them. I'm producing hundreds of thousands, maybe a million jets per neutrino. So you've got a lot of opportunity to screw things up. A lot of things can go wrong with a jet. You can have just plain old mismeasurements, right? Sometimes, you know, the measurement just ends up being high or low for whatever reason. You can have particles down cracks. That can decrease the energy because you missed the particle. It can also increase the energy if it happens to hit just the right spot in the crack. For example, you saw the fibers. If a particle goes across that fiber, it starts emitting Cherenkov radiation along that fiber, which then gets captured and sent to the phototube. So it looks like an enormous amount of energy has been deposited rather than a tiny amount, if it just clips it just ever so. Particles can end up in dead regions of the detector. Detectors all have dead regions. Right? You have to hold them up with something. You can undercorrect, you can overcorrect. That can mismeasure things. You can have particles in a jet that just happen to decay into a leading neutrino. So suppose what you have is a leading kaon. So the most energetic particle in the jet is a kaon. It's carrying half of the momentum, and it decays, sticking that neutrino forward. Half of that energy is gone forever. All of these sound unlikely, and the reason they sound unlikely is because they are unlikely. But I'm making a million of them, and that gets us back to triggering. Jets are everywhere. A few percent of events contain a jet. And if one in a million can fake your signal, well, I'm making a million of these to every signal event, so I end up effectively looking at jets. So it's the triggering that really causes you trouble, because you're not picking up events and putting them in your data stream that you weren't ever interested in. So I will now give you Lecomte's three laws of triggering. Number one, you cannot analyze an event that you did not trigger on. And there are no do-overs. Once you've decided you're going to reject that event, you can't go back and say, you know, that event last April, I really wish we took it. So two is, if you're not going to analyze an event, it doesn't help you to trigger on it. So of that kilohertz, don't fill it with crap. You will have a lot of meetings where someone will say, well, we should write this out because just maybe someday someone will need this. This is a terrible reason to write something out, because you could be writing something out instead that somebody would want. You've got a thousand slots, you have to fill them carefully. And the third part is, if you're going to cut an event, cut it as early in the chain as you can. There's no point in taking an event at level 1 to level 2 to level 3 to level 4. Level 5 says, now I don't want this. If you can cut it at an early level, it's better to do this. You are now better experimenters than most of the field. All right, you've seen the various pieces. Now let's put it together and see what we get. These are building blocks, not Legos. You take, for example, an electron plus missing ET from your neutrino, and now you've got a W. And imagine the word candidate from everything there, because it might be real, it might be fake. I'm talking about things generically. If I take two Ws and two jets, maybe with B tagging, and I'll tell you what B tagging is in a minute, and now you have two top quarks. If I have a muon and a jet, I've got a leptoquark, and so on. So all of the things that we're looking for are made from combinations of these more elementary objects, like electrons and muons and jets. So what is B tagging? And if there's time, I can talk about taus as well. B hadrons live for an incredibly long time by particle physics standards. They live for a picosecond and a half. That's an eternity. That's long enough for them to travel roughly at beta gamma of 1, half a millimeter, 450 microns. So when we're talking typically of 20 GeV, 30 GeVs, these things go millimeters. That's forever. So I stole this from Matt Strassler, who used to be a stringer, then became a phenomenologist, and then became an investment banker. Or something like that. A generic jet, say from an up quark, you've got the collision point, and every track comes from that. A B quark, on the other hand, moves a few millimeters and then decays. So if you look at the tracks from the B daughters, they come to a secondary vertex where that hadron decayed, which is several millimeters away from the primary vertex. This is more than enough to tell that it's separate. So this is a picture, an older detector with a weaker detector. And you can see here, this is a B that decayed to J psi, to two muons, K pi, 723 microns from the interaction point. You can see 723 microns. Right? That's like the thickness of a credit card. And then this other B went further. Now, the other thing you should take a look, you should take away from this is, how did we get this B? Because there are two muons in the decay. It's very difficult to trigger on an event just because it has a secondary vertex. LHCb has managed to do that, and they get a lot of props in my book for making that happen. This experiment, on the other hand, said, I'm looking for pairs of muons, and then was able to root around in the event to find out that this was a BB bar event. One B and the other. So we look at displaced vertices. Typically at an LHC experiment, there's about a 70% chance. I see you, I'll ask you in a second. 70% chance if it's a real B, you'll call it a B. And about a 1 in 100 to a few hundred case that it's not a B, you would call it a B anyway. And those numbers can be adjusted per analysis. Yes?
When you have lots of pileup, how can you tell if this is a displaced vertex from central interaction or just different?
So we have pileup, but the pileup is occurring along the beamline, and we know where the beamline is. Right?
If this was along the beamline, you wouldn't be able to tell it was.
So the problem, less of a problem at the LHC than at CDF, the problem at CDF was that the beam was tilted. So when you have pileup, it not only moves along the axis, the beam axis, but it also moves things in the transverse plane.
You mean tilted with respect to the detector?
Tilted, right, exactly. And a lot of work was done in a country called Canada, the University of Toronto, to solve this problem by putting the silicon on little tiny motors so that you could adjust the silicon after the fact so that the beam was going, if not down the middle, at least it was going along the same axis. It turns out, I mean, this is a small detector, right? This is, well, it's 22 feet, whatever that is in meters, 7 meters or so tall. This is a tiny thing by LHC standards. But even so, positioning it to within a millimeter is hard. The rule of thumb from the guy who did it was one big whack with a sledgehammer moved it 100 microns. And that's how they did the final offset.
Did they have incremental smaller whacks when they were really fine-tuning?
No, because it turns out that the friction is such that if you give it a smaller whack, it doesn't move at all. CDF, in fact, rolls uphill both ways. You know, when your grandparents just said, when we went to school, you know, we went uphill both ways in the snow. CDF actually did move uphill both ways. It slid in and out of the collision hall, but since it weighed so much, if it's sitting here and you move it over there, the whole building did this. And then when you move it back, the whole building did that. With that going on, it's very hard to position to within 100 microns an object this big. So this is something we actually do worry about.
Sorry. Can you remind me why CDF was tilted? I mean, with respect to the...
No
physical.
Yeah, there's no physical. It was not intentional. It's just that if you have an object that's a cube 7 meters on the side and you're trying to position to where it is to within the size of a human hair, which is 50 microns, that's a really hard thing to do.
So how did they do it at the LHC in Atlas?
It's not done much better, but we have a clearer idea of what needs to happen to the detector. So the detector looks more like the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Right? The Leaning Tower of Pisa, if you ever look at it, it's not leaning, it's actually curved. Because when they built it, it started leaning. They thought they could maybe, you know, kind of patch it and nobody would notice. So the thing that matters the most is the silicon detector, and that it has a somewhat independent positioning system relative to the rest of the detector. So if I have something which is 4 meters away from the beam, I don't really need 50 micron resolution. But if I have something which is wrapped around the beam, I do. So the detectors are designed so that they don't have to be completely concentric, so that the precision detectors are lined up exactly the way they need to be, even though the whole detector might have an offset of 100 microns or so.
How big is the beam pipe that the protons or electrons are going through before it hits a detector? Okay.
What's that, centimeter and a half? So all of this business is going on in vacuum. It's nowhere near the detector. For extremely boosted Bs, this is actually an issue, because if you've got a really boosted B, it's going to go, let's say, you know, beta gamma is 100 and it goes half a millimeter. Well, now it's going 50 millimeters. So not only does it cross your beam pipe, it's missing the inner few layers of silicon. And one of the things on my to-do list, if I, you know, ever get a chance to do science again, is to look at Bs that are found far away and actually have a track inside the silicon. So I would like to see if I can see a B plus actually as a meson traverse the silicon. And one of the ways I can tell that we're doing things right is the ionization for a B is different than the ionization for a proton. Those of you who are following this offline, it's my idea. All right. Let's put some of these things together. And hey, I got it pretty close, right? I was a few minutes early. So this is, we showed you some Higgs to gamma gamma plots yesterday. This is Higgs to gamma gamma in CMS. You can see, even though the technologies are different, the signature is the same. That's photon one, that's photon two. They've drawn a dotted line here to show that there's no track hitting photon one. Photon number two, they drew the dotted line anyway, but it in fact has a conversion. So there are two tracks that went there. So they say, there's an even number of tracks here, so this is photon one. All right, this is a non-conversion, this is a conversion. You see all of this other stuff that's going on in the event. Right, but it's fairly soft. This is Higgs to tau tau. I didn't talk about tau identification. I don't like tau leptons. They're sneaky little things. They masquerade as hadrons. You only see them by their decay. They fly about 70 microns. They look like really skinny jets that have either one prong or three prongs. So one prong is they decay to one charged particle. Three prongs is two of one charge, one of the other. Rarely there are five prong and even more rarely seven prong decays. We don't pay any attention to those because that's a couple of percent. So they look like skinny jets. They're kind of hard to work with because there are a lot of skinny jets out there. Hopefully I've convinced you that there are a zillion jets per interesting object. So normally what you will do is you will look for an excess of one and three prongs over two and four prongs. That's the thing. But anyway, here is, let's see, do I know what this is? Yeah, it's a Higgs to tau tau candidate. Put the word candidate in front of everything that I show you. So I've got a jet here that the Higgs candidate is recoiling against. I have a little bit of missing energy here. This is because the tau's decayed to neutrinos as well as the one or the three prongs. So you expect a little bit of missing ET. This had a single particle track. Which is measured in the calorimeters. This has three prongs, and I can only see two, so one of them must be covering up the other. So these are the sort of things that look like tau events. One of the nice things about di-taus is that I can, the background is suppressed because it's rare for one jet to fake a tau. It's rare squared for two. All right, so I can look and if I require one of these guys to look very tau-like, the other guy tends to have, am I doing something wrong? Okay, the other, just checking. The other, you're looking concerned, that's why. Once one of these looks very tau-like, the other one tends to look very tau-like too. This is Higgs to ZZ goes to mu EE. And if I were smart, I would be able to tell you which one was on-shell and which one is off-shell. But if I look at the central detector here, I have two things that look like electrons, two tracks, energy in the electromagnetic calorimeter, and I've got two muons here where I've drawn the muon chambers there and there. This is what it looks like in the interaction region. This is the interesting event. Both muons and both electrons and both muons come from the same point. And I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 other vertices in the event that I don't care about. At the time, 8 concerned us. Now that we're dealing with almost 80, eight is great. Yes?
In something like that, can you spatially separate where the two Zs come from, like the points, the vertices?
Like that, or do you mean something more? Yes. So we're able to track them all the way back to the origin points and discover the two muons and the two electrons come from the same point,
right. Yes.
Which is what we want. So if, for example, the two electrons came over there and the two muons came there, we'd say, we have two different interactions, can't possibly be a Higgs. Let's remove this from our sample. So I'm hoping I'm giving you the idea that it takes all of the detector subcomponents working in concert to explain what happens with any individual collision. This is a very pretty DiGet event intended for public consumption, not actual physics analysis. And you can see there's lots of green and yellow everywhere. These are the two jets. This is the energy deposited in the calorimeters. And we can show from this, we can see how did the jets evolve. This is what we actually use for doing this. All right, so this is a more useful thing. This is what the actual scientists use. I again have two jets. I have two jets. This jet might be a little mismeasured. Why do I think it might be a little mismeasured?
Because it hits the crack.
Because it's near the crack. All right, so it's possible that there's some energy lost over there. There's not, but it's possible. If you look at it in the calorimeter in these the so-called Lego plots, you can see clearly two jets, very little additional activity. And all of the particles in the jet come from this vertex and not the other ones, not the other four. If this is the one I'm thinking it is, and it's not, but we'll pretend it was, our highest energy jet pair right now is about 8 TeV of center of mass energy, which is pretty impressive out of a 13 TeV beam. You can have a top anti-top pair. We talked a little bit about light things uniformly populating rapidity. Top isn't really heavy and it isn't really light, but it's light-ish. The whole event is in one half of the detector. So it's all in the second unit of rapidity. That's kind of one of the reasons we decided to make them as long as it was, is to minimize the events that you couldn't reconstruct because a piece of it was too far forward. This is the electron. Missing ET is opposite the electron, so that's one W from the decay. The other W is decay to UD bar or CS bar, and it formed two jets, one from, let's say it's UD bar, one from the up, one from the anti-down. And then there are two B decay jets here and here. And if you looked in up close, you'd see that there are secondary vertices from this and that. So this puts everything together. Now, I promised yesterday we'd talk about Higgs to WW. So it's an animation, so we can watch W's come up over time. Should have done this with holding your hand and taking them down when you thought that we had significant results. And then we make it red so it's easy to see which are the signal events and which are the background events. So a couple things you should take away from this plot. Unlike gamma gamma and unlike ZZ star, oh, let's do it again. So put your hands up and then put them down when you, or let's do it the other way. When you believe in the signal, put your hand up. When you believe it's real. I'm learning a lot. So first thing I've learned is that you're kind of three sigma people. Second thing I've learned is community is important because you're all kind of looking around saying, I don't trust my own physics judgments. I only trust the physics judgments of those around me. All right, let's see if I can.
Your hand never went up.
I wouldn't have published this if I didn't believe it. So let me try and stop it around here. Ah, that's how I wanted to do it all. Good enough. So a couple things to learn. No, stop. Many different backgrounds. We have to understand many, many different backgrounds for this analysis in a way that we didn't for the others. I gotta fix this one of these days. Next thing to understand, the peak in the signal is exactly over the peak in the background. This is, I'm gonna be kind to my colleagues, undesirable. Which is more convincing? Oh, yeah, the background's over here. or the background's over there. As a general rule, you don't want to have your background peaking and your signal peaking at the same point, because the whole line of argument in this now depends on, do I understand my background from first principles? Whereas if I saw a peak, I could make the argument that I don't need to understand my background, I can measure it. So why did we do that? Is it because we're stupid? Come on, somebody's thinking that.
Presumably the background is just the other one.
No, we have control over that. We have control over the background because the kinematic cuts shape your background. Right? Where the background peaks is driven by where our cuts are set. So we do have control. I mean, maybe not full control, but we have some control over that. Right? The reason is we were worried about getting as many Higgs events as possible. So we set our cuts to get as many Higgs events as possible. A side effect of that is it shifts the background to sitting right underneath the peak. I will predict that you will see in the future different cuts made to get the background away from the peak. Because nobody is going to question whether we've got the Higgs anymore. It's a question of what you can do with it. So we're going to move things apart so the background and the signal shift each other. And now you're behaving. All right.
I have a question.
Yes.
So if you use this for like a Higgs search, right?
And we did.
Yeah. So how do you generate Monte Carlo already with the assumption? Because once you have a W and Z, right, don't you already assume that you have a Higgs?
No. Most of the background here is WW. So this comes from...
No, but this is what I'm saying. Like if you go in like your Monte Carlo generator or something, this already has a like Higgs input in it. And then you say, like, decay WW to, like, emu.
Right, but we also say, let's look at WW that do not come from Higgs, which is our primary background. So the Feynman diagram has a box of quarks and two Ws that come across of that. And one of the things that we do is we say, the Higgs is different than those Ws. Right?
Okay.
Right? Because those Ws don't know anything about each other's spin. Right, because you sum over initial states, right? Average over final states. When you sum over the initial states, you're summing over the polarizations of the two input quarks. So you're producing Ws in all sorts of spin combinations. The ones that come from the Higgs are all spin zero. And the effect of that experimentally is the two leptons are close to each other. When a W decays, it throws the lepton forward and the anti-lepton backwards. So if I have a W plus W minus of opposite spin, the two charged leptons go in the same direction. So this search isn't a generic search for particles decaying to WW. It's a search for scalar particles decaying to WW. And the background is completely spin independent. So one of the tricks we can use in the future to adjust the background is to try and do basically a partial wave analysis to pull out any spin zero component of the background and to infer the difference, you know, measuring with the two leptons far away, use that to better constrain what's happening in this particular plot. Yes? No? All right. Another event. This is a heavy ion collision from CMS. I wish we commissioned with heavy ions because this lights up absolutely everything in the detector. And if you have a dead channel, you know it right away. As it happens, we didn't. This is lead-lead collisions. I think I mentioned yesterday that lead-lead collisions are more expensive than gold-gold collisions because? I need isotopically pure lead. All sorts of wacky things happen with lead. This is lead-208. Lead-210 is everywhere. It's radioactive. It's produced from cosmic rays. If you're doing a low background experiment, you may hear this later, people use solder made with lead from sunken Spanish galleons and old Roman pipes because this is lead that has been sitting around somewhere long enough for the 210 to decay. There is one lead mine in the world that has low lead-210. It's a place called Doe Run in, I believe, Missouri. If you're ever buying lead for one of these experiments, you go through a broker so that they have no idea they're talking to a physicist. Because once they know it's a physicist trying to buy their lead, the price goes up an order of magnitude. because they know there is exactly one mine where this works. So one of the interesting things about heavy irons, and I'll just say this interesting thing and then move on, and that is the heavy ion fireball here is the hottest thing we've been able to make on Earth, and it's the world's best refrigerator. It has an absolutely phenomenal heat capacity. And the effect of that is when I have a quark go through that medium, it loses almost all of its energy. And this was discovered by looking for diejet events and discovering that there were events that had a jet on one side and nothing on the other side because that jet was eaten by the medium. I was on shift watching this happen in real time. That was kind of fun. All right, 5 minutes. I'm going to start talking about electrons. I probably won't finish, but hey, we have an afternoon. In the past, there were electron-positron colliders. I've talked mostly about proton-proton colliders and proton-antiproton colliders. One of these discovered the J-psi. That's a particle that looks like a psi. The J looks like Sam Ting's name in Chinese. That's the reason that they're called what they are. This is actually a psi prime. It's the first excited state of the J-psi that decays to a J-psi, which decays to electrons and two pions. That's why it looks the way that it does. People use these all the time. Now, because the electron is elementary, 100% of the beam energy can be used to make particles. That's why somebody here asked, I'm already forgetting who, yes, how you could do this at LEP or as Clio and do a three-dimensional constraint, because I knew that everything that went in ultimately went into one of these particles. At a PP machine, stuff goes out in the beam pipe, so I don't have that third-dimensional constraint. But this is an advantage. It also makes searching much more complicated, because I have a very narrow beam, and that's as much of a liability as is a strength. J-psi has a partial width of, I don't know, 40, 50 kilovolts, right? It's 3 GeV. There's an awful lot of 50 kilovolt windows in 3 GeV to step through. So you have an issue if you're trying to use this as a search machine. If it's really, really narrow, you can drive right past the thing you're trying to search for. You can also only produce states that have the same quantum numbers as the photons, since you're producing them through a virtual photon. And this makes sorting out what you observe possible, because you know this particle has the same quantum numbers as the photon. It's 1 minus minus, because you made it. You know that some of the things that it might decay to do not have the same quantum numbers as the photon, because you didn't make them directly. So it helps you sort out this mess. So these look like great things. Why don't we have more of them? And the answer is synchrotron radiation. This is the key equation to building an electron machine. The power in synchrotron radiation goes as e to the fourth over m to the fourth r squared. Electrons radiate way, 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 way more than protons, because I've got a factor of 1840 to the fourth power, which is big. At LEP, these give you very hard x-rays. At LHC, which is in the same tunnel with protons, it's in the near UV. If you could stick your head in the LHC beam pipe, you would be able to see the synchrotron radiation from the protons as they go on by. At LEP, you need continual acceleration to replenish the energy. LEP loses 3 GeV per turn on a 90 GeV machine. The four LEP experiments are actually not working in the center of mass, because one of the beams has slowed down more than the other has. So two of them, they're moving to the right, and two of them, they're moving to the left. This is actually an issue they had to worry about. The LHC, I did write that down. The LHC number is 7 kilovolts. So even though it has 70 times the energy, it has much, much less energy loss. Going to a big tunnel doesn't really help you much, because I only win as r squared. If I want to double my energy, I say, okay, fine, but I take a penalty of 16 here, and that means I need to go to radius four times larger before it'll do me any good. All right, so there's a lot in this equation. You say, well, I can solve this problem because this is power per electron. Maybe I'll just use fewer electrons. That works. But then you lose in luminosity because I don't have so many electrons in the beam. So basically, this equation is why the LHC is 70 times the energy of LEP, despite being in the same tunnel. If I tried to get up to a reasonable energy using electrons, all I would be doing is making synchrotron radiation. I believe I have time for one more plot, saying how saying all the problems with electrons, and then in the afternoon, I'll tell you how great they are. This is a plot made by LEP where they scanned over the Z-pole. That's their data points, which are almost invisible because the error bars are so small. And the error bars were, in fact, inflated by a factor of 10 so that you could almost not see them. So they scanned the energy so that they could map the width of the Z boson. Looking at the events where they could see the partial width of the Z in any individual channel. You could look Z to jets, Z to muons, whatever. The difference between the total width and the partial width, some of the partial widths, is the invisible decays. You produced a Z, but you didn't see any decays. And that are neutrinos. And if you say, I'm going to assume that the invisible width is all due to neutrinos, how many generations are there? The answer you get is 2.984 plus or minus 0008. So this tells you that there aren't two generations of neutrinos, there aren't four, the answer is three. And if there's any new physics in here, it's got to make it just a tiny, tiny effect. So I think I'm going to stop there and let you have lunch. Let me rephrase that. I'm going to let me have lunch. But I'll be happy to entertain any questions that you have at the moment. Questions?
Can you explain how they get the 2.984 number? That's just from there's a sum when you're computing the partial width, like the branching fraction,
there's a sum. Right, so there's three flavors of neutrinos. Each one has a partial width of, I should know this, 4% times 2 GeV or so, whatever that works out to. So that's the number, that's the missing partial width that you have. I then divide that by that 4% number, and I get 2.983. Yes?
I mean, the occasional dosage, that is quite a few uncertainties away from actually being
here. Yeah, isn't that kind of an interesting question? I'm sorry, that wasn't a question, that was a statement. I don't have to answer statements.
Sorry. do you have any idea, what does that mean? Or is there anything, should I be concerned about the fact it's not exactly three? What does it?
I don't think you have to be concerned about that. I mean, I think the answer is that there are three. You might worry about issues like, you know, could this be new physics? I think the real answer is probably not.
Okay.
Right. I mean, remember, this calculation is done to tree level, certainly, and maybe one loop. Mm-hmm. Right. I can certainly believe that at one loop you're perturbing a branching fraction by 8 parts per mil. Right. You guys do this for a living, right? Do you believe that at one loop you could perturb a branching fraction by a couple parts per mil? Okay.
So that means it's underwater space.
Hmm? Yeah, well, this is what happens when you use tree level or whatever the order, the finite order that we work to. So I'm not worried. Most people aren't worried about this, right? It's clearly, you're not going to, at one loop, change this by 33%.
Isn't this number, the 2.984, is really close to measurements of an effective from CMB, right?
Yep.
In that they're significantly just below three.
You can decide if this is, could there be new physics? I bet if someone were willing to give me a beer to come up with a model that would slightly depress this, I probably could. But I'm not going to say this is great evidence for this. This is why people talk about sterile neutrinos as well, because the number of active neutrinos is pretty clearly three or three-ish.
Tom, are you sure about the number of zeros there? Is it 0.008 or 0.000?
0.0008 is right. So maybe there's another 9 in there. But even so, it's a little low. People know that. I've got to fix these slides anyway because I have the yes, maybe, no, maybe thing, which one of the things you will learn as you go through your careers is that errors appear on slides where there were no errors before. Anything else? Okay, get yourselves fed. Okay.